Our next speaker is Donald Abrams.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I want to start by telling you a little bit about how I got into this field of doing research on marijuana. It's been a path that's been ongoing for the past 11 years. It started in 1992. I am an AIDS doctor, as was mentioned. I'm also newly appointed the chief of hematology oncology at San Francisco General Hospital. So I take care of patients with cancer and patients with AIDS, and that's what I've been doing during my career. In 1992, the AIDS conference was being held in all places in Amsterdam. And I was in my hotel room, some of you understand that, yes, glancing at CNN when I noticed Mary Rathbun was being arrested. Mary was a volunteer in our clinic at San Francisco General Hospital. She was about 70. She was known as Brownie Mary. She won the Volunteer of the Year Award 2 years running because she came and took our patients to x-ray and took their blood to the lab and picked up their prescriptions, and she also baked brownies for her kids. And here I was in Amsterdam watching Brownie Mary being arrested in Sonoma for baking her brownies. When I got back home, there was a letter addressed to the director of research at the AIDS program at San Francisco General Hospital. Somebody brought it to me thinking I was a good enough person to respond to it. And it was from Rick Doblin, who's the president of the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS. Rick is a PhD graduate of the Harvard School of Government, and his particular interest is in drug policy reform. And Rick suggested that a clinical trial demonstrating the medicinal benefit of marijuana should come from Brownie Mary's institution, as if she were our dean or something. Well, 1992 was a bad year for people living with HIV because we really had no drugs. We only had three, and I had just finished a trial comparing the three of them. So as a clinical trialist, this was sort of a gauntlet that I decided should be picked up. So I began to develop a clinical trial to look at smoked marijuana in patients with the so-called AIDS wasting syndrome, a very common condition at the time where patients lost weight, became very skeletal, had diarrhea, no appetite. And marijuana is something that these patients were using to a large extent, obtaining it from Dennis Perone's cannabis club in downtown San Francisco before it was closed. So we designed a clinical trial, Rick Doblin and myself, to send it off. It was really readily approved by the Food and Drug Administration, surprisingly. The University of California Institutional Review Board had 4 pages of issues that I addressed. Ultimately, the question became obtaining marijuana for the study, and we needed to go to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, where Alan Leshner was the director at that time. Alan and I have a correspondent that's on the World Wide Web. It gives me a number of Google hits. But basically, he sent me back a letter after 9 months having reviewed my proposal and said that he was sorry that he could not provide us with the marijuana for this clinical trial because the study was not scientific. Here it had been approved by the FDA, by the University of California, and controlled substance studies in California also need to be approved by the California Research Advisory Panel, or CRAP. CRAP actually, because I've told this story so much, CRAP has changed their name to the Research Advisory Panel of California, so I can't make that little joke. Anyway, it was a little bit upsetting to me that Alan Leshner called our study unscientific when all these other bodies had approved it. Turned out later on, Alan and I became somewhat friendly, and he explained to me that something I didn't realize. The National Institute on Drug Abuse has a mandate from Congress to study substances of abuse as substances of abuse and not to provide them to researchers who want to study these substances for potential medical benefit. As he said, Donald, we're the National Institute on Drug Abuse, not for drug abuse. So Alan Leshner, before he left. Anyway, so ultimately, In 1996, HIV changed because protease inhibitor drugs became available that could really suppress the virus. The wasting syndrome disappeared. This was the year that we in California voted for Proposition 215. And if you recall, at the end of the year, Barry McCaffrey, flanked by Donna Shalala and Janet Reno, got up there on December 30th, 1996 and said, no, 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 physicians in California and Arizona cannot talk to their patients about use of marijuana because we will do all these terrible things to them. And that's when physicians finally began to mobilize. The National Institutes on Health got together, the Institute of Medicine began to investigate this, and everybody said, we need more research. Having already written two proposals, we were ready to write a third. And the availability of protease inhibitors gave us a new twist, because these drugs are metabolized in the liver by the same system that metabolizes cannabis. So we proposed a clinical trial not to see if marijuana was effective in patients with the AIDS wasting, because AIDS wasting disappeared, but to see if it was safe for people on protease inhibitors to smoke marijuana, fearing that there may be some sort of a drug-drug interaction between cannabis and their drugs, or cannabis and their immune system, because there was all this concern about what effect marijuana has on the immune system. This was successful. And in 1997, we were awarded $1 million and 1,400 of the government's finest 3.95% THC-containing marijuana cigarettes. We conducted a clinical trial from 1998 to 2000 in which we enrolled 67 patients and housed them in our inpatient general clinical research center at San Francisco General Hospital for 25 days. One-third of the patients took Marinol, which is synthetic Delta-9 THC. One-third took Marinol placebo, and one-third smoked a NIDA cigarette three times a day for 21 days. Again, the endpoint of the study was what happens to the level of the AIDS virus in the bloodstream, with also a look at the immune system, the level of the protease inhibitors, and since we had the patients there, we were also going to see what happened to their caloric intake, their weight, and their body composition. We completed the study. The study was published, I'm happy to say, August 18th of 2003, after having been rejected by four major August journals. It was rejected in the Annals of Internal Medicine, it was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, who had previously rejected it, but I appealed it because I said, they had published the results of my study in a thought piece on medical marijuana the year before, and I said, here I'm sending you the original research, I think you should publish it. And after a year going back and forth about the statistics, they ultimately published the study. I will say that the first August journal that rejected it, named after a region of our country in the Northeast, one of the reviewers, the peer reviewers, said that they felt that in one paragraph rejection said that these authors sound more like activists than scientists. I was a bit shocked, and I've been rejected by that journal on a number of times, and I said, you know, this is a bit biased, and I would be, if I were you, ashamed to have sent this to an investigator, a letter that's so politically biased and rejecting this paper on the basis of that. The reviewer's comments, when a paper goes out for peer review, peers review it and send back the comments. And the reviewer's comments in all the journals that rejected the paper were quite favorable. I think it was the editors of these journals that were concerned about publishing a study that showed our results. Our results being that there was no impact on the HIV viral load, that there was no significant drug-drug interaction between cannabis and the protease inhibitors, that the patient smoking marijuana gained weight 3 kilograms compared to 1 kilogram in the placebo group, and that in fact the immune system seemed to get a little better in the people smoking compared to the people on placebo. So, anyway, the study's done, it's history, and fortunately for all of us, we live in the state of California, although who knows what's going to happen next week, but although we've heard Governor Davis sort of lambasted, he did approve or not veto John Vasconcellos' subsequent bill, which provided money to establish the Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research at the University of California. I have now been awarded 3 grants to study 3 different conditions in clinical trials. Currently, we are doing a study in patients with HIV and painful peripheral neuropathy, which is nerve damage leading to very severe pain in the hands and feet. Patients with peripheral neuropathy do not benefit from opioids, but they do seem to benefit from cannabinoids or cannabis. So we have just completed a pilot study, and now we're doing a randomized placebo-controlled trial of smoke marijuana versus smoke placebo. We also have a study for cancer patients who are taking opioid narcotics and still have pain. This study is looking at the interaction of cannabis and the opioid analgesics to see if together they provide an additive pain relief, which we believe they will. We're finally currently doing a study in women with breast cancer who have delayed nausea and vomiting secondary to their chemotherapy to see if cannabis or Marinol provides relief. And the final study that I just hung up from the FDA with this afternoon discussing is a study to look at the Volcano vaporizer as a smokeless delivery system. I believe personally that marijuana has medicinal benefit. This is not news. People have known this for 5,000 years. In fact, it is only over the last 70 years that physicians in this country could not prescribe cannabis. What I find myself in the midst of now is a somewhat Sisyphean, if that's the right word, effort to reprove that marijuana is medicine. And we live in an era of evidence-based medicine, so my goal is to produce evidence that will hopefully convince people that need to be convinced that this is a drug that benefits people who need it. Whether or not this is a possibility in our lifetimes remains unclear, but it is the goal of the work that I'm doing. With that, I'll stop, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Donald. Our next speaker is Edwin Dobb.
Another concern is the people controlling the process of definition. In other words, who determines the way problems are framed, the terms that dominate public debate, the often hidden or deliberately obscured assumptions that steer and constrain solutions? The two questions are, of course, intertwined, and taken together, they constitute an inquiry into the exercise of power. Just such an inquiry is needed, I believe, to expose what may be missing or underappreciated in our approach to the use of such illegal mind-altering substances as marijuana. Judging from the language, stories, and images that dominate mainstream media, the troubles that accompany drug use can be understood in two general ways. On the one hand is the medical perspective, with its emphasis on illness, treatment, and physicians. On the other is the punitive perspective, which stresses moral weakness, punishment, the police. Note that both models are based on roughly the same assumption, that the problem springs from some form of individual inadequacy. Certainly those who actually provide the treatment or mete out the punishment may and often do hold a more complex, less exclusive view of the people in their charge, especially of the reasons why human beings make a habit of ingesting mind-altering substances. But I'm speaking here of the debate as it plays out in the public domain, the fundamental terms that define how we as a society frame the issue before us. Essentially, that's a bipolar world inhabited by sick people and bad people. It's also a relatively new world, brought into existence in 1914 with the passage of the Harrison Narcotic Act, which for the first time in this country made the use of some mind-altering substances a crime. During the past 90 years, the pendulum has swung between punishment and treatment, with punishment clearly being the preferred alternative, the one to which we devoted by far the most time and resources. Indeed, among the early consequences of the Harrison Act was the arrest of physicians who refused to stop prescribing drugs how and when they saw fit. As if there weren't enough about this wrong-headed, profoundly destructive social experiment to induce despair, consider that we are once again harassing, arresting, and incarcerating physicians. Physicians who, employing not only marijuana but powerful opiates, would dare to relieve patients of excruciating, often end-of-life pain. Perhaps nothing so clearly exemplifies the worldview of those prosecuting the war on drugs than the demonization of doctors. As in the war on terrorism, the rhetoric has become wildly inflated and misleading, allowing for the exploitation of fear and ignorance and the cynical promotion of self-serving rationales for curtailing the private behavior of our neighbors. In such a politically as well as emotionally charged climate, we must choose our words carefully. For at least a generation, and under both Democratic and Republican administrations, the threat to society posed by the use of illegal substances has been deemed so grave that the only reasonable solution is one that's described in military terms. The policeman is now a warrior, and the warrior can't do his jobs if his hands are tied. Ridding the world of evil is a dirty business. Blood will be spilled. Collateral damage can't be avoided. And it's not enough. Really, it's never been enough to counter this view with one that simply replaces warriors with healers. By allowing ourselves to be seduced by the traditional bipolar scheme, and with few exceptions, the mainstream media still encourages this outlook, we inadvertently ignore a more fundamental issue, rights and responsibilities in a democratic society. By insisting that the only alternative to the rhetoric of punishment is the rhetoric of treatment, we make it easier for those who believe that the war on drugs justifies placing new restrictions on the freedom of individuals. But if instead we move the discussion into a civil liberties context, the considerable and ever-growing dangers of the war itself come into focus, and the strategy of the warriors is exposed for what it is in effect, if not intention, an assault on the principles upon which the Constitution is based. At the most fundamental level, the issue isn't one of sickness versus health or bad versus good. It's what lengths do we believe the state can and should go to monitor and control the voluntary, private use of any substance, regardless of its effects upon the individual. Seen in this light, the societal problem that truly demands our attention isn't drug abuse, it's the abuse of power. Preventing the government from overstepping its bounds is probably the quintessential and enduring topic of debate in robust democratic societies. So it's no surprise that the terms were set long ago, and in this regard, never so forcefully as in John Stuart Mill's essay On Liberty, written in 1857. Since this goes to the heart of the matter, it deserves being quoted at length. Here's what Mill wrote. The only purpose for which power can be rightfully exercised over any member of a civilized community against his will is to prevent harm to others. His own good, either physical or moral, is not a sufficient warrant. He cannot rightfully be compelled to do so or forbear because it will be better for him to do so, because it will make him happier, because in the opinion of others to do so would be wise or even right. The implications couldn't be clearer. The state shouldn't use its police powers to punish adults for what they ingest, period. Nor, and this needs to be emphasized, should the state compel treatment. Over himself, Mill says, over his own body and mind, the individual is sovereign. And with such sovereignty, we must remind ourselves, comes responsibility, should one person's exercise of rights lead to excess and bring harm to another. To favor legalization is not to favor a cruel free-for-all in which no one is held accountable for his actions. But once the principle of individual sovereignty is violated, all civil liberties are at risk, which is the same as saying that all citizens are at risk, which is another way of saying that as remote as the use and sale of illegal substances may seem to some, the war on drugs, like the war on terrorism, is our war, like it or not. It's being fought in our name, after all, and with our tax dollars. More to the point, a government that has no qualms about abridging the civil liberties of your pot-smoking or cocaine-snorting neighbor could just as easily show up on your doorstep with an equally unwarranted and intrusive plan to prevent you from harming yourself. Merely a partial list of the drug warriors' current assaults on liberty explains why former Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall referred to them as the drug exception to the Constitution. Ed mentioned some of these. I'm going to run through just a few just to give you a feel for how many different ways we're at risk. Here are 10 reasons why U.S. citizens should take exception to the drug exception. Restricting free speech. That's one of the primary reasons we're here this evening, of course. And I just want to note that, again, the hypocrisy of those in power who profess a distaste for governmental intrusion yet are intolerant of states' decisions in this regard. Invasion of privacy. Drug testing is now so routine that we scarcely question it. But it has severe consequences, even though it's an unwarranted invasion of privacy. No necessary connection exists between urine analysis tests and impairment, and the tests can be inaccurate. Imagine getting fired, for instance, for having had a drink the previous Friday night. That's, in effect, what's happening. The state is monitoring and punishing private behavior that's unrelated to job performance. Violation of due process. Civil asset forfeiture, the seizure of cars, homes, and other property, has become one of the nasty little secrets of law enforcement agencies because they've grown dependent, as Ed has pointed out, grown dependent upon the proceeds generated. More alarming, though, is that despite recent reforms, property still can be seized before a person is convicted of a crime to greatly reduce the discretionary power of judges, leading to grossly disproportionate forms of punishment. Other disparities include those introduced under the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of the late 1980s. For example, the most egregious example, the difference in punishment for different amounts of powder cocaine and crack cocaine, 500 grams in the case of powder, 5 in the case of crack, with the same sentencing. This obviously discriminates against poor and minorities, as most of these do. Denying access to education. In 1998, a federal law was passed banning federal aid to students who've been convicted of drug crimes. Incredibly, convicted murderers and rapists are eligible for financial aid, while those convicted of marijuana or other drug charges are barred from a year to life. In the last 3 years alone, about 90,000 people have been denied aid. The law obviously discriminates against the poor, those most in need of education. Homelessness. In 1996, the Department of Housing and Urban Development enacted a one-strike-and-you're-out policy whereby a single drug crime on or off housing premises can result in the eviction of an entire household. Not only does this provision deny people the right to due process, which prevents one person from being punished solely because of the actions of others, of another, it targets low-income families, those for whom the prospect of homelessness obviously is most devastating and consequential. Disenfranchisement. In 13 states, ex-felons are barred from voting for life. And in the war on drugs, as we know, thousands upon thousands of people are being convicted of felonies every year. Destruction of the social net. The Welfare Reform Act of 1996 denies for life cash assistance, food stamps, and other benefits to any person convicted of a state or federal drug offense. Now 19 states continue to impose the ban in full, while 31 have eliminated or modified it. Once again, even murderers and rapists escape such punitive measures. And once again, the law targets the poor, as well as children. According to a 2002 report by the Sentencing Project, more than 92,000 women and 135,000 children are affected by the welfare ban. Misuse of informants. Frequently, the only evidence against a defendant is the accusation of an informant. Under current rules, such informants can remain anonymous. And given the pressure on everyone involved to plea bargain, defendants often never get the opportunity to confront their accusers. A further abuse is the over-reliance on the testimony of a single biased witness. The recent case in Tulia, Texas, which most of you probably heard about, is obviously an egregious example. 12% of the black population of a town of about 5,000 people were arrested solely on the word of a corrupt undercover agent. But that was preceded in 2000 by the arrest of 15% of the black males in the town of Hearn, Texas, this time on the word of an informant who'd agreed to implicate certain individuals. All the men were innocent. Nightfall, as former Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas once said, does not come at once, neither does oppression. In both instances, there is a twilight when everything remains seemingly unchanged. And it is in such twilight that we all must be aware of change in the air, however slight, lest we become unwitting victims of the darkness. Changes in the air brought about by the war on drugs are now so numerous and troublesome that they cannot be ignored without risking deep and possibly permanent damage to the republic. It is dusk, and vigilance is required to navigate in the fading light. This is the responsibility not of experts in law or medicine or sociology, though their skill and wise counsel are surely needed, but instead all citizens. Nor should it be left to the drug warriors who, even as we sit here tonight, are laying plans to conflate the war on drugs and the war on terrorism, concocting something called the Victory Act, which could greatly expand the government's power to seize records and conduct wiretaps, make it easier to seize property, and so on. The so-called drug problem, redefined as an abuse of power problem, dictates a very different set of solutions than those that usually dominate such discussions. And they all stem from an awareness of and willingness to fight to maintain the real locus of power in a democracy, the people. The warriors can pursue their ill-conceived war only as long as we permit them to do so, only as long as we defer to their mad vision, only as long as we view ourselves as spectators, unwitting victims, in the words of Douglass. Civil liberties cannot exist in the absence of citizens who, on the one hand, exercise them, and on the other, defend them. In the defense of liberty, no one should be arrested, charged, go to jail, or in any way suffer coercion at the hands of the state for possessing or using drugs of any kind. Besides protecting individual rights, this approach would greatly reduce corruption of law enforcement agencies and help restore the integrity of the overall judicial system.
Thank you, Ed. For those of you who have not followed it that closely, of course, the USA Patriot Act has a successor, which was termed Patriot II. Of course, the Patriot Act was cynically named Patriot Act to appeal to the public. And when the Patriot Act began to get bad PR, of course, they changed or renamed the Patriot Act II to the so-called Victory Act. So that's the next thing on the horizon. Our next speaker is Robert McCoon.
Thanks, I'm really delighted to be here. I think the civil liberties issues are quite important, but I'm going to change direction a little bit and focus more on some empirical questions about the effects of drug laws on drug use. I'm actually going to say very little about medical marijuana because I actually don't think medical marijuana is really what's at issue here. I think the risk of medical marijuana systems leaking marijuana into the recreational community is such a trivial problem that I find it extremely difficult to rationalize the federal government's interest in this. Taken at face value. But I think clearly what the federal government's really interested in here is symbolic politics, the symbolic politics of medical marijuana and the perception that medical marijuana is really a Trojan horse for marijuana legalization. And I think they're surely right. I think it's clear that the medical marijuana issue carries tremendous political importance. I've been tracking Gallup polls measuring opposition to marijuana legalization, and if you look back over 30 years, the opposition has been very stable among adults at 75-80% of the population. Only recently have we seen that opposition really start dropping, and I think the opposition is really starting to drop in part because the federal government has shown pretty much the same kind of political acumen that the Fox News lawyers showed when they went after Al Franken, which is the problem with going after medical marijuana as an issue is that medical marijuana really brings into focus public views about what we're actually achieving with marijuana prohibition. Jimmy Carter, when he was president, amazingly, when he was president, said penalties against the drug should not be more dangerous to an individual than the use of the drug itself, and when they are, they should be changed. Nowhere is this clearer than the laws against possession of marijuana. So I want to open up the context a little bit by looking at, what would actually happen if we decriminalize marijuana, depenalize marijuana, legalize marijuana, and I come at this not as an activist telling you what to believe, but as a policy analyst, definitely not funded by the federal government, but funded by the Alfred Sloan Foundation, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, to look at this question empirically. And I've looked at this in various different angles, looking at historical evidence, cross-national comparisons, looking at experiences with alcohol and tobacco regulation and so on. So I just want to tell you about some of the things we know, and we don't know everything we'd like to know, but the federal government has been complaining about Canada's recent decision to decriminalize marijuana and saying that they're bad neighbors, that they're poisoning our neighborhood. And the Canadians were good enough neighbors in the 1970s not to accuse us of being bad neighbors when 11 of our states decriminalized marijuana. In fact, we did it first. 11 states in the United States decriminalized marijuana, meaning specifically possession was downgraded from a felony to a misdemeanor. And it varies from state to state how this is implemented, whether there's a quantity limit or a frequency limit or so on. But and so that's one of the sources of evidence we can look at. And when we look at that evidence, we are unable to find any effect of that legal change on levels of marijuana consumption. They're just, you can't really detect any. There's one study that has shown a very small effect. Nobody else seems to get the effect. Even the study that finds an effect is very tiny. Australia, several regions of Australia have depenalized, I prefer the term depenalization because I think it's clearer, have depenalized possession of marijuana. Both cross-sectional and longitudinal studies failed to find any effect of this on levels of marijuana use. The U.S. is increasingly isolated in marijuana policy as country after country relaxes their marijuana laws. The U.S. federal government has really been bullying other countries into trying to toe the U.S. party line for a long time, and a lot of countries are finally saying, no, we're going to go our own way. Canada has said that. Great Britain has said that. Many regions of Germany have said that. Australia, Portugal, Italy and Spain, it's actually not well known, but Italy and Spain have already decriminalized marijuana back in the 1970s. And we don't find effects of removing penalties for possession on use. And this is a big part of what this debate is about, and this looming specter of depenalization just does not look like a very serious, like it has any serious consequences. I do want to talk about distinguishing depenalization from legalization and talk a little bit about legalization. Legalization would involve actually allowing legal sales of marijuana. And here we really only have one contemporary example, and even that's not a perfect example. The Netherlands, by the letter of the law, cannabis sales are prohibited in the Netherlands. Don mentioned Amsterdam and people laughed. A lot of my research has been in Amsterdam. It's a tough job, but somebody's got to do it. What the Dutch actually did was they have a written policy of non-enforcement of sales of up to 5 grams of marijuana. The evidence on the effect of commercial sales are very ambiguous, and it's very hard to know for sure what's happening. I will say, during the 1980s, when there was a dramatic increase in the number of coffee shops and the visibility of coffee shops, and during a period in the 80s where there was a lot of advertising by these coffee shops, the Netherlands was the only country that had rising levels of marijuana use. In Europe, the United States had falling levels during that time. I think it's not implausible that commercial promotion did lead to some increase in use. Having said that, it's very hard to find any indication that that's in any way harmed Dutch society. And in fact, levels of marijuana use in the Netherlands are now significantly lower than in the United States. The Dutch, interestingly, the reason why they allow coffee shops to sell marijuana is that a sociologist in the 1970s, a Dutch sociologist, argued that there was a gateway effect, that marijuana led to hard drug use. And the Dutch concluded that they needed to soften their marijuana laws. How did they reach this conclusion? Because they believe the causal mechanism of the gateway is that young people come into contact with hard drug users and hard drug dealers, and so they wanted to separate the markets. It seems to me, in my book, I review some evidence that the Dutch have successfully done this and that they've actually weakened the gateway. It seems to me that probably a less risky way to reform marijuana laws, if you interpret increased use as a risk, and not everyone does, would be to follow the model used in Alaska and in South Australia, which is to allow legal cultivation of a small number of plants for personal use. There's no commercial promotion involved. There's no advertising involved. And it separates the marijuana market from the hard drug market without the risk of commercial interest. And in our book, we take a very jaundiced look at the tobacco industry, gambling industry, alcohol industry, and there are a lot of problems with moneyed interests getting involved in intoxicating substance. So when we look at the looming specter of you know, sort of what are the threats faced by the slippery slope of medical marijuana, I don't think that the threats are really all that serious, and it's worth looking at them directly. And I think what's happening is increasingly many countries are looking at the evidence and concluding that it's just very hard to justify an aggressive American-style war on marijuana. Thanks.
And thank you, Rob, very much.